face-to-face resistance that they lose. But they have also been very, very successful in some respects. So I think the question, in the end, the question is, it's in the balance. And it's in the balance, and it depends on what people do to resist Zionism. Because, of course, although they are now back in Gaza, having a really very, very bad time, the Palestinian resistance, the Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, I mean, having a huge success with their operations in Gaza, it's quite extraordinary. It's not impossible that they will seek to expand their power in a way which we have hitherto not thought possible. And that, of course, is what the normalisation Zionisation process is about. It's about expanding their sphere of influence through the whole of the region, effectively running Saudi Arabia, running the United Arab Emirates, and that's what the project is. So it's not impossible that they will have more success in that area, and it really depends on what the resistance axis is able to do to stop that.
And talking about the resistance axis, Vanessa, of course, the events in Syria will have undermined the resistance axis, or its ability anyway to resist. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Syria was the main land bridge for the transfer of weapons and assistance from Iran through Iraq and into Lebanon and Palestine. But Syria was also one of the primary manufacturers of the weapons, and particularly the missiles, used by the Lebanese and the Palestinian resistance for decades and still being used. And now, of course, the weaponization, the security agreement between Jolani and Netanyahu, which is being strongly denied by the Syrian al-Qaeda regime, but appears to be coming to fruition, is to use the Jolani Takfiri elements, particularly the foreign Takfiri elements, the Uyghurs, the Chechens, the Uzbeks, against Lebanon. They're not going to succeed in a war against Hezbollah, that's for sure, but what they can do is to occupy Hezbollah in fighting them on the eastern border and the northern border, while potentially Israel will invade from the south. And of course, this is all in preparation for the restarting of the aggression against Iran. Yes. And this is very clear as a result of the ceasefire that Israel will pivot towards weakening Hezbollah and the Iraqi resistance before it replenishes its munition supplies and looks to restart some kind of aggression, whether it's hybrid or direct aggression against Iran.
Yeah. And just before we go to our next report, Vanessa, just say a word or two, will you, about the NSO group where Tony Blair's wife, Cherie, is an ethical advisor.
Well, I mean, you know, the NSO group is the manufacturer or the developer of the Pegasus malicious spyware, and it's no accident that Cherie Blair is involved in what could have potential alongside Oracle and, as David said, all of these other Unit 8200 Zionist intelligence operations that are infiltrating all sectors of Western society and Western governments. But the Pegasus spyware, of course, is being used or has been used in the past to surveil dissident politicians and journalists. And it's clear that this is one of the most potent weapons in the Zionist war box. That, of course, has been used against the Palestinian resistance. And we've been saying for a long time that what you've seen being weaponized against the Palestinians is eventually going to come home to roost in the West amongst the governments that have been supporting Israel in committing their genocide since 1917.
Sure, no, indeed. Well, we're going to move to our next report now, which highlights just how deeply entangled with the Israel lobby Tony Blair really is.
Tony Blair is a very well-appreciated figure in Israel, said Israeli former Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, and how right she came to be. It's a little-known fact that Israel lobbyists were also key to Tony Blair's election as the leader of the Labour Party, and then even his election as UK Prime Minister, through his close relationship with Michael Levy, known as Lord Cashpoint. Simultaneous to fundraising for Blair, Levy also worked as a fundraiser for Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and had a son, Daniel Levy, working for Israeli Justice Minister Yossi Beilin. Blair was first introduced to Lord Levy by Israeli Embassy Officer Gideon Meir, while Blair was a humble shadow Home Secretary. Levy then set about raising funds for Blair, obtaining them from key Israel lobbyists like Trevor Chan, who funds Starmer and Lamy now, Emmanuel Kay, Labor Friends of Israel, and chair of Westfield, Frank Lowy, who fought in the ethnic cleansing Haganah during the Nakba of 1948. Israel lobbyist Lord Levy also obtained a £1 million donation to Labor from Formula One boss Bernie Ecclestone, which had to be returned to avoid allegations of cash for favors. When in government, Tony Blair strong-armed Michael Levy into a position of influence at the Foreign Office as an unofficial envoy to the Middle East. Later on, once prime minister and knee-deep in service to the Zionist lobby, Blair delivered a speech at the annual Labor Friends of Israel reception in September 2006. "I have never actually found it hard to be a friend of Israel. I am proud to be a friend of Israel," said Blair, now a long-time reliable asset.
David, I mean, as we've just heard in the report there, I mean, the Israel lobby played a significant role, didn't they, in getting Tony Blair the keys to 10 Downing Street and obviously therefore becoming the Prime Minister. I mean, what do you know about the role that they played?
Well, the fallout between the Labour movement and the Labour Party and the Zionist movement in the period between 1967 and 1993 or 4 or so, when Blair becomes the leader of the party, was quite significant. And pro-Palestinian politics became much more important on the left. And you had in that period, in the 80s and 90s, you had all sorts of actions taken by the left against Zionism. But when Blair comes in, that's when that starts to change, and that's when you start to have the increased importance of Labour Friends of Israel, which of course had been in existence for some years. You have the role, in particular, of Michael Levy, who was introduced to Tony Blair by the Israeli ambassador, and they would then play tennis together.
Yeah,
and he became known as Lord Cashpoint. He was his fixer. He would get the money in, and then of course he was given this, as we saw in the film there, the role in the Foreign Office. So this was a sea change in the way in which the Labour Party operated. So the Labour Party moved from a kind of social democratic position, skeptical about Israel and Zionism, to a position which was much more in favour of Thatcherite policies, neoliberal policies, but also much more in favour of Zionism. So it's a total change, and that's what we're seeing the after effects of now. And of course, the party became very disillusioned with that, and that's why they elected Jeremy Corbyn in 2015.
Yeah, indeed.
So that's the kind of arc of this. And of course, we're now back into a kind of on steroids pro-Israel position in the Labour Party.
Sure, yeah, no, indeed. Well, Vanessa, I mean, how does Tony Blair compare, do you think, to other prime ministers in the extent to which he embraced the Israel lobby?
I think, as David has just described, you know, Tony Blair was instrumental in empowering the Zionist movement in the UK and in UK politics. And, of course, we have to ask the questions with the Trump refusing to release the Epstein files, and now apparently we're told that Epstein killed himself, had committed no crimes, and Glenn Maxwell is in prison for nothing. We know that the Zionist movement works through systems of incentivization and compromising, in other words, blackmail, and there's not only one Epstein, there are probably thousands of Epsteins working globally. And I think the question has to be raised. All of these people, like Tony Blair, who was certainly one of the most prominent that was brought to power by the Zionist movement, to what extent is he compromised by the movement in some way? And I think, you know, investigations should be made into the potential for his compromisation in some way, but also what incentives are being offered to Blair, other than power and status and influence and so on. And it's very clear from the Tony Blair Institute that now he's working very hard on embedding the GCC, Gulf Cooperative Council, so all of the Arab Gulf states, into the Zionist bloc. And I think that is one of his most important roles on behalf of the Zionist movement.
Yeah, indeed. But David, what about the role of Lord Levy in enlisting these kind of funders? I mean, our old friend Sir Trevor Chin and Frank Lowy, for example.
Well, I mean, as I was saying about the, you know, about the role of Levy, he was Lord Cashpoint. He was the one who brought the finances. That Labour was not going to be critical of Israel. It was not going to challenge the wealth of the wealthy Jewish donors who were being tapped. And he was the one who brought all that to bear. And Chen, of course, is the most important of these, in the sense that he's effectively and has been effectively since the 1970s the leader of the British Zionist movement. He's been at the head of the biggest Zionist charity, the United Jewish Israel Appeal, and it had previous names before that, since the 70s, or I think even further back than that, and he remains at the top of that organisation. So he is effectively the leader of the Zionist movement in the UK, and of course he has very strong links with directly with the Zionist regime. And so you have the way in which this worked is that you have there's sort of different strands of Zionist funding for the political parties. So Levy brings in the ones who are traditionally favourable to a kind of moderate left neoliberalism. There are others who are much more conservative. And then you have some who are willing to play bipartisan. So, for example, Gerald Ronson of the Community Security Trust, who's a hard-line Likudnik, but who will nevertheless fund the Labour Party if it has advantage
right,
for it.
Right, yeah, indeed, of course. Well, Vanessa, I mean, what was Israel's role in pushing for war in Iraq then, do you think?
Oh, I think, I mean, that you have to look at the Clean Break Doctrine in 1997, which was effectively a strategy paper written by CIA operatives, commissioned by Netanyahu. And this was all about the partitioning of the Middle East or West Asia region into sectarian statelets that would be easier to manage for Israel and also potentially more sympathetic towards Israel. So this was the early, if you like, Abraham Accords plan. And then the war against Iraq was incredibly important to basically install U.S. military bases in Iraq to threaten both Iran and Syria. And in fact, from the Clean Break Doctrine and commentary on the doctrine itself, we know that the road to Damascus was through Baghdad. So it was very important for Israel for Iraq to be effectively destroyed as a functioning resistant state to the presence of the Zionist entity in the region, and to prepare for the war against Syria, and then, of course, the war against Iran.
Yeah, no, of course, of course. And David, I mean, briefly, because I think we're nearly out of time, I mean, the son of Lord Levy seems to be getting quite a lot of pro-Palestinian airtime on Qatari-funded platforms, doesn't he? Are you buying that?
Well, no, of course, this is Daniel Levy we're talking about, who used to work for the Israeli government.
Yeah.
And now poses as pro-Palestinian. And some of the things he says, if I was to say them, I would be accused of being anti-Semitic and all the kinds of things that you say. So he says some stuff which is quite sensible in some respects. But, of course, there's a limit to the sense that he will do. And it's a limit which is effectively sympathetic to Zionism in the end. And I saw Levy. I was in Doha last year, I think it was. So I'll leave it there, having a cosy lunch with Ben Jamal, the head of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, another organization called Soft on Zionism. Yeah. And that's how this works. There's people who appear to be pro-Palestinian, like Al Jazeera, like Daniel Levy, like Ben Jamal, but actually they're effectively covertly working for the Zionists.
But what's Levy's game then, do you think, in terms of, you know, trying to kind of portray himself as
The Zionists want to work both ends of all games. That's what, and so when people say, oh, well, Jeremy Corbyn couldn't possibly be a Zionist, look at all the pro-Palestine stuff he's done. Well, you say, well, actually, his position is a Zionist position, and the Zionists want to pressure from all sides, and that's why when the Zionists come for Jeremy Corbyn, people say, oh, he couldn't possibly be a Zionist. Well, the Zionists will play all sides of all games.
Yeah, no, of course, of course. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back next week. I'd like to thank our guest, Vanessa Bealey, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the commentary points of Surah Al-Qasas, the 28th chapter of the Holy Quran. Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing the 85th verse of Surah Qasas. Let's listen to the verse once again, and we'll be back.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Inna alladhi farada alayka al-Qur'an laradduka ila ma'ad. Qul Rabbi a'lamu man jaa bil huda wa man huwa fi dhalalin.
Indeed, O Muhammad, he who imposed upon you the Quran will take you back to a place of return. Say, my Lord is most knowing of who brings guidance and who is in clear error.
So, regarding this 85th verse, as we mentioned, we said that the verse is revealed under specific occasions based on some of the actually narrations. But as we said, the narrations of Raja'a are widely transmitted, and Raja'a is of the self-evident knowledge of Shi'i sects. And we will also bring you some verses in the Holy Quran that adapt to it. For example, the Holy Quran says, "He is who sent his messenger with guidance and the religion of truth, that he may prevail it over all religions, though the polytheist may detest." هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون. So there are some other verses of the Holy Quran which do the same as well. But up to now, the religion of Islam has not prevailed over all religions, and the promise of Allah has not been yet done. But it will be, and it will not fail. And this belongs only to the period of Raja. So that's why this verse is also important, since this verse could also be added to the verses that continue the discussion and actually prove the existence of something like Raja. The late Sayyid Murtala Alam al-Huda has narrated in his book Muhkam wa Mutashabih from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam that this verse relates to Raj'a in this world. I mean, inna alladhi farada alayka al-Qur'an laradduka ila ma'ad. Verily, he who has revealed and ordained the Qur'an unto you will bring you back to the destination. And the verse continues, قُلْ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ مَنْ جَاءَ بِالْهُدَى وَمَنْ هُوَ فِي ضَلَالٍ مُبِينٍ. Verily, he who has revealed and ordained the Quran unto you will bring you back to the destination. This part relates specifically to Raj'a, and his knowledge had reached to a point that he knew this verse. And once Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was asked about the commentary of this verse, and he alayhi salam said, "By Allah, the world will not end till the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam meet each other in that specific place. And they will build a mosque there, the doors of which will be numerous." That place, that specific place, is mentioned in the traditions, which is a province in the suburbs of Kufa. So, dear listeners, regarding this verse, we said that the beginning part of this verse is specifically related to the concept of Raj'a. And also, the important thing is that the Holy Quran adds that the Holy Prophet must treat very carefully against these actually obstinate opponents. Because the Holy Quran says, قُلْ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ مَنْ جَاءَ بِالْهُدَى وَمَنْ هُوَ فِي الظَّلَالٍ مُبِينٍ. Say, "My Lord knows best him who has brought the guidance and him who is in clear error." So, somehow, it has been suggested that the way of guidance is clear. And, of course, when the way of guidance is clear, the path to aberration is also manifest. So, what's the point? The point is that the Almighty Allah is well aware, and the truth-seeking hearts also know this reality. They know how to go for it, they know where to look for it, and they know the exact way to reach it. And that's the, as we said, the manifest commentary of this verse. But as we said, there are some other commentators who have delivered some other probable meanings upon the Quranic word ma'ad. And the purpose of ma'ad, as these commentators believe, is the concept of returning to life after death, the land or the rank of the great intercession, or even paradise, or even Jerusalem. Anyway, up to now we have sufficiently discussed the contents of this 85th verse of Surah Qasas. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. Your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Across the seven skies, see a pure heart never lies. The words you learn will never earn. It's time to think and wonder why. Stars above will always be a shining guide for us to see. And when I doubt, I'll have no doubt, but still I wonder why. Digging through our pages past, wondering how the truth will last. God's in control is what I found. I think I'll try this time around. And no one really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as unfold. Their glory is unique, we're told. The stories mark a precious past, but do we question why? A quest for truth can never be a lot I faked inside of me. I walk in shoes I've never felt, only then I'll sure know why. They tell me just make up your mind. The path I seek just needs a sign. The end is where I wanna be. Which way I go is up to me. And no one really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as me. I know you cared as much as me. Our stories were shared for us to see. And perhaps it's best to part and be. And maybe we'll find the path we seek tonight. Let it be. Only God really knows what's right. Maybe.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we started discussing some of the jurisprudential laws related to clothing and conspicuous garment according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei last week, actually, or last session. And we'd like to continue along the same line, if you don't mind. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. Is it permissible for men to wear women's clothes? And even vice versa, you know? I mean, women wearing men's clothes inside their house, though, without the intention of emulating the opposite sex?
Well, we know that, generally speaking, it's not permissible for a man to wear a woman's clothes, and the vice versa is also true. When it comes to wearing the clothes and garments of the opposite gender, there is a consensus among the religious authorities that in public, a person cannot wear the garments and clothing of the opposite gender in general public, you mm-hmm. see. That's not permissible.
Okay.
But when it comes to one's own house, if a man chooses to wear his wife's garment,
yes,
there is no problem, because it's okay for the wife to accept her husband wearing her clothes.
Yes.
And the opposite is also quite okay. It's permissible. And the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, have not objected to this scenario.
Mm-hmm. So it's no problem actually at home?
Yeah, of course.
I see. Okay, fine. Well, what's the ruling in the matter of men buying or even selling women's lingerie or even underwear?
Well, there's no harm in it. You know, in and of itself, it's okay, it's permissible for men to sell women's clothing
mm-hmm.
and lingerie, of course, as you said. Of course, they have to sell it, and people need them. Okay, the ladies can buy these things from them.
Yes,
but if it includes some kind of trying in front of the man, it's not permissible, because these are undergarments. And a woman cannot wear these undergarments in front of the a non-mahram man. Okay, so when it comes to buying and selling these things or it is quite permissible. Otherwise, when it comes to wearing them in front of a non-mahram, it's not permissible.
Mm, I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to clothing and conspicuous garment, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to make, buy, or even sell transparent stockings?
Well, the answer is very much like the answer I gave earlier. There is no objection to making and trading in these things, stockings, lingerie, women's special clothing, provided that they are not intended for women to wear before men who are non-mahram to them.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from the answers I gave, according to the fatwa of His Eminence Colonel Ismail Khamenei, that it's not permissible for a woman to wear transparent and see-through clothing. Mm-hmm. They are so transparent that their bodies and the shape of their bodies could be seen.
Yes, of course, in public.
Yeah, in public, of course.
But not at home for their husbands.
Yeah, of course. So women, Muslim ladies, should be careful not to wear those tight clothing. The clothing should not be so tight as to show the attractive parts and the contour of the woman's body. And also they should not be very much, they should not be revealing see-through, or let's say use the word transparent, transparent clothing. We see, like, for example, in countries like India and Pakistan, unfortunately, we see that they are wearing a kind of hijab which is very thin, very transparent. The ladies wear them, and it has become a commonplace among the Muslims, ladies, Sunnis and Shias. We see that they wear clothes that are very much revealing.
Mm-hmm.
They consider it as hijab, but it's not real hijab. Real hijab is a kind of hijab which does not show the contours of the body, and also which are not see-through, you see, transparent. And that's not the case with ladies, especially in most, countries in the Indian subcontinent, like Pakistan and India.
I see. Shah Javed, is it permissible for unmarried men to work in boutiques, selling women's clothes and cosmetics, provided that they abide by the religious laws as well as ethical norms?
Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, the permissibility of legitimate work and earning halal living is not confined to one group of people, you see. It is therefore permissible for anyone to go about their business, to work, to engage in trading, to buy things and sell things, provided that they abide by the Islamic norms and ethics. Mm-hmm. There are certain ethics and certain rules and norms which must be observed, and these are religious norms, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, if the competent authorities require special conditions for trading in certain sectors which may have been designed to protect the public interest, they have to be observed. Those rules designed by the authorities, the qualified authorities, in order to maintain and promote public morality, must be abided by.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. The topic is still some of the jurisprudential laws related to clothing and conspicuous garment, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javed, you know, one of the things that sometimes you see that, even men wear is some kind of chains or necklaces. You know, we know that the necklaces are usually worn by women, right?
Yes.
But sometimes men wear chains. Is there any problem with that?
I don't think there is any problem. based on what I understand from the fatwa of the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, it's generally speaking, there is no problem whatsoever in wearing such chains, provided those provided that those chains are not made of gold. And we know for sure that it is not permissible under any circumstances to wear gold ornaments. Okay.
Right.
For men, it's forbidden. And, of course, gold is forbidden for men. And whether it is in the form of necklaces, whether it is in the form of, let's say, a ring or any other items. Like, for example, I've seen in some you see weddings, in the families of the bride give a gold ring to the groom, and the groom wear it on the wedding day.
Yes.
So this wedding day does not make give him a license to wear the gold item, the gold ornament. He should not wear the gold ornament. You see.
But what about platinum, which is called white gold?
If
it's not yellow,
it's, if it is considered gold in common view, the color is not important.
No.
So if in common view it is considered gold, the color does not make any difference.
I see.
Can be yellow, it can be white. So it's forbidden for men and to wear them. And also when it comes to, let's say, utensils, we see that utensils made of gold and silver are not permissible to use, and it's, and they are not permissible to use for ladies and for men equally.
How about gold teeth?
Gold teeth, again, it's not permissible for men to wear. Yes,
I see.
Like wearing gold teeth.
How about crosses or any emblems and symbols of other religion that sometimes even you see, unfortunately, some a few Muslims actually wear? Is there any problem
when
with wearing like crosses?
Crosses
which show basically Christianity, right?
Yeah, of course. If they somehow is a kind of confirmation of their beliefs, of their values, and of their practices, like wearing a cross, it is not permissible according to any religious authorities. We cannot wear a cross and tell other people that I believe. This is the message that we give. By wearing a cross, we believe that, okay, the for example, Prophet Jesus was crucified. When in fact, the Quran teaches something else.
Yes.
He is still alive, and we do believe based on the Quranic teachings.
He was never crucified in the first place.
So wearing such such items would contradict our belief. And would give other people think that, would make other people think that, okay, we believe in such things while we do not. So if it is considered confirmation of their beliefs and their values, their
principles, but if they wear it for like ostentation, like they like it and they wear it, and they don't want to show that, for example, this is their conviction.
But whether you like it or not, what the other people understand is very important.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, whereby we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to clothes and or clothing and conspicuous garments according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Good morning to all listeners from around the world. You're tuned in to Iran Radio, coming to you from Tehran, and I'm Asma, your host for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with a radio productions feature. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. After that, we have Around the World with reporters. Reporters from around the world tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from countries both near and far. Our varied radio productions feature will be next. And our final program this hour is A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran as well as inspirational poetry and stories. Stay with us for the next hour.
Power is the ability to affect others to get what you want. You can affect others to get what you want in three basic ways. One is with threats and coercion. We sometimes call that sticks. The second is payment. We often call that carrots. And the third is to get people to want what you want by attraction and persuasion. And that's what I call soft power.
After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth. I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
U.S. troops have been moving around in the Middle East and leaving behind a trail of destruction and insecurity for 20 years. Perhaps that is why the United States eventually decided to put an end to its presence in the region, not because it cares for the people of the region, but because it wanted to change its image in the minds of these people, an image of the U.S. government as savior.
Gentlemen, on your marks, get set.
seeks to be savior of the world must win the hearts and minds of the people of the world, and to achieve this, he must step forth with a weapon other than military hardware.
Well, you can see it in the invasion of Iraq. The United States went into Iraq without the legitimacy of a second United Nations resolution. And when you look at public opinion polls, you see that the U.S. lost about 20 to 30 points of attractiveness on public opinion poll scales in Western Europe. But an even more dramatic example is Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world. In the year 2000, the United States was attractive to 75% of Indonesians. After the invasion of Iraq, that drops to 15%, 1/5. That's a huge loss of soft power. No, it can be regained. For example, when the United States helped or used the Navy ships to help provide tsunami relief after the 2004-05 tsunami, then you got an appreciation of the attractive aspects of the United States. And the polls show the United States going back up into about 40% range in Indonesia.
Now the American soft power movement tries more than ever to hide behind the native people of the Middle East to justify its presence in the region. Organizations such as USAID, USIP, and NED, with their humanitarian and freedom-seeking slogans, have reached out to the people of the Middle East and are trying to use the indigenous people to carry out their cultural projects.
Oh my God, an explosion now.
Oh my God!
America's cultural presence in the Middle East is older than its military presence. It might be hard to accept such a thing in the current situation. After the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan under the pretext of a terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, it was a military image of the United States that was shaped in the minds of the people of the region. But military presence is only a part of U.S. strategy in West Asia. Currently, there are several major, apparently cultural currents at work in exercising Western soft power in the Middle East. USAID, USIP, and NED are all U.S.-born complexes with well-organized programs operating outside the United States. They each have stories that will be very thought-provoking. The United States Agency for International Development, USAID, the United States Institute of Peace, USIP, says its goal is to prevent and resolve conflicts around the world. The National Endowment for Democracy, NED, states that its goal is to promote democracy in the world. We will talk more about how true these claims are in practice and what results they may have achieved so far. But why is West Asia so important to the U.S.? Alfred Mahan, a historian who was a U.S. naval officer, wrote in his book, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, "The first step to gain global power is to have a strong navy and control of the seas. Any government that controls the most important straits in the world, such as Gibraltar, the Suez Canal, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the Cape of Good Hope, the Malacca Strait, the Strait of Magellan, and Hormuz Strait in the Persian Gulf, will be the most powerful government in history." The Middle East is among the vital and effective regions in the geopolitical equations of the world. The Middle East is the center of the old world, the center at the heart of which is the Persian Gulf as the heartland of the world. The term heartland is an old concept coined by Halford Mackinder, dean of the London School of Economics and Political Science. Geopolitically, he considered the heartland to be beyond the reach of shipping lines and between the Volga River and eastern Siberia and the Himalayas and the Arctic Circle. He linked this relationship with power relations in land and naval power struggles, and believed that control and domination of the heartland by any power would lead to its world domination. course, the existence of a complex issue such as the occupation of the Palestinian territories and the presence of Israel in the region has made the Middle East, this inflamed region, more sensitive than ever. And all given factors have become an incentive for the United States to become more insistent on staying in the region. Interestingly, the U.S. National Security Council is at the forefront of all U.S. military and civilian decisions for the West Asian region. And all that is said to justify these decisions is, it is for the sake of the security of the American people. It is as if the people of the Middle East, and even the people anywhere else in the world, are parasites to the American people, and have the right to live only under the conditions set by the Americans. The United States considers itself an exceptional nation, the new Israel of God, sent to save the world. This is the view both American political parties hold. This boastful remark about Americans being exceptional also includes former President Ronald Reagan's statement about America, which called America the shining city upon a hill. Reagan's words refer to remarks by Puritan leader John Winthrop, who quoted the words of Jesus Christ, a city upon a hill on which the eyes of the world are fixed.
So a report like this is a message not only to poor countries.
A part of American exceptionalism is nonstop war. Jeffrey Sachs, secretary of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, believes that American wars in the Middle East are not wars of necessity, but wars of choice for power. If we delve into the hidden layers of history, we will understand why the U.S. military invades countries and imposes its military presence on them afterwards. The destruction of the vital infrastructure of the country in question will make the government of that country incapable of any action, and it'll find itself on the edge of a precipice. It is at this point, with the collapse of the ruling regime, that the United States steps in and, by supporting the indigenous elite who are dependent on it, changes the course of government in that country. It is natural that the new government created after the collapse of the previous system is weak and inexperienced, and usually resorts to the occupying forces to solve its problems, big or small.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
But the U.S. won't be done with the occupied country at this point. This is just the beginning of a complex process of influence. But what does influence or infiltration mean? Influence means changing the lifestyle of the people, plus changing the mindset of the elites of the country in question. The U.S. attempt to influence the culture of the people in the Middle East is not a new phenomenon. If we follow the trace of American cultural presence in the Middle East to change the cultural taste of the people, we reach the distant years of the 19th century, when for the first time,